Hello and welcome to A Vague Idea. This is a comedy trivia podcast. I'm Nate Regolia. Each week, we subject our guests to a list of topics to find out if they have a vague idea. This week, we are blessed with a returning guest. He is an actor, he is a drinkor, and he is a rancor. Have you ever tried to eat Luke Skywalker in a pit underneath Jabba's palace?
You know, I can't say as I have done. You know, now that you mention it, I think I had a little Luke Skywalker toy when I was a kid, and I am absolutely certain at some point I definitely pretended to be the Rancor. Like,
excellent.
Coming out of the thing. And then all this stuff. Yeah.
Well, thank you for not making a liar out of me, Seth. Seth Harris is back on the show. How are you?
I am doing very well, Nate. Thank you very much. How are you doing?
Oh, man, yeah, you know, it's the same old in the land of perpetual ignorance and disease.
Yay.
So we're just living every day to its fullest.
I will raise my affogato to that.
Right on.
That's questionable.
Courtney does not believe that this is an affogato because it is not espresso and vanilla ice cream.
It's not an affogato. It is a misappropriated version
of what an
affogato is.
More of a cold brew float.
Okay, well, so yeah. I mean, I think we're going to, let's talk about appropriation of European titled foods in a minute. But our second guest is you're a newcomer. Have you ever listened to this show, Courtney?
I have not. Seth asked if I wanted to listen to it earlier. And I thought that would be an unwise choice for me.
And I said, no, I will not listen.
I wanted no precedent. I just wanted to be able to sit and just see what happened, what came out of my mouth in response to what was coming out of your mouth.
Well, I appreciate that you took a llama's-like approach to say, you know what? I want to be infinitely curious and infinitely ignorant at the same time to take on the Buddhist baby mentality.
That's
I'm into it.
I am a little Buddha baby.
So what do you do, Courtney? What's your jam? What's your deal, huh?
I mean, I like long sits on the couch, and I would say that I like going to farmers markets, but that doesn't happen. No. What is my jam? My jam right now doesn't exist. So, but my jam prior to the apocalyptic world that we find ourselves in was also theater. Mm. I was an actor in New York for a long time.
Oh, right on.
I've been an actor, a teacher, and then throughout my time as an actor, as you do, I spent a lot of time in restaurants. So. Restaurants and food actually really are, those really are my jam.
Excellent. Yeah. I mean, I've been cooking a lot lately. My wife and I get a food box each week from Purple Carrot. So it's all vegan stuff. Mm-hmm. And I've managed to really learn over the last, I don't know, year of my life that all of my mistaken beliefs about the difficulty of cooking and the tedium of it have been completely dispelled.
Oh, good.
Like instead, I just realized, like, oh, you know what's great is just Brussels sprouts, vegetable oil, salt, pepper, and an oven, and you can actually, like, live big, like, better than any snack food that I would acquire by going in the middle of the grocery store. So, yeah, I'm a big proponent of cooking now. Quick question, Courtney, as an actress who lived in New York, how overrated is Hamilton? Be honest.
Well, it's so overrated that an actor living in New York can't get a ticket to it. I mean, I could actually if I had pulled. I think the problem is that if you pull a few strings, you can certainly get one. But I don't think it's overrated. I don't think that it's overrated. I do think that. I do think that it kind of shines a light on something that. Is kind of innately problematic about the way theater works in our country right now, okay. which is just that it can become so sensationalized that theater and so many things art related can become so sensationalized that kind of their true nature is being obliterated by capitalism, I guess, is the best way to put it.
So, yeah. I mean, I think capitalism is the worst thing to happen to most things that aren't specifically like owning a factory and making money off of the things that you produce in the factory by yourself. Like, I'm talking about a hand crank factory where one person goes, okay, every day I turn this crank and I make sugar cubes, say, and then I sell them at the market, but I don't employ anybody or underpay them, nor do I, you know, exploit people's creativity or anything else.
You retain all of your own surplus value.
Yeah, it's almost as if labor is the most valuable component in the system.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, my wife and I saw Hamilton, but we were only able to ever see it when we were in London, which was crazy that we were able to get tickets there to see it. Because we had tried several times in New York and in Denver, and no, you can't do it. And now there will never be theater again.
Never
theater is dead. 3,000 years of tradition obliterated.
Yeah. I think we all need to start doing our own one-person, two-person plays in the sanctity of our homes and maybe just broadcasting them over Zoom. I would probably get into that if it was a thing where I could donate. Like, if you guys wanted to do a two-person play, and I'm talking, like, just hats for costume changes, whatever you need to do to switch characters. And books are... We got scripts coming out.
I think the reason why theater is obliterated right now, it's actually, I mean, for right now, I mean, I think it should be, because the theater, and it kind of connects back to where I think Hamilton has gone wrong, is that theater is meant to be a place for everyone to gather in person and be able to see something that will hopefully connect with them in some way to facilitate change. And the gathering of the people is really what makes theater theater. Yeah. And so when that's not possible, you can't have theater. And when you make it impossible, because it's impossible, because only the top tier of human beings can afford the ticket,
Whether you're excluding 90% of people because it's too expensive to get a ticket, or you're excluding 100% of people because there's a fucking pandemic, at the end of the day, 90% of people, one way or another, are not going to be able to see theater if we keep doing it the way we've been doing it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we have an extraordinary, well, Courtney and I could both go on at length about the...
We don't need to do it.
I was going to bring up to the point that you made that, you know, many of Shakespeare's plays were originally like political satire, right?
Right.
They're near historical political satires of kings that just were in power, or parodies of in power rulers, which is kind of, I mean, that's one of the things that I think, aside from the capitalistic aspect of Hamilton, that I sort of wish it did a little bit better at, was really like pushing more politically than it does. It's still groundbreaking, but it's also very, like, I mean, it's going to be on Disney Plus, so it can't be that revolutionary.
At the end of the day, it still celebrates the capitalist landowning class that founded this country in this really dubious way.
But you can also argue that it's making stories of, you know, it is bringing voices and faces to the general public that so there's this really wonderful side of it that I fear that we're losing sight of what its intention and what it, but maybe we're not. I mean, maybe its intention is just to bring diverse voices and faces to the forefront and just make it as accessible to as many people as possible. And if putting it on Disney Plus does that, great. Let's bring diversity to the forefront and make it accessible to everyone.
But
we have lost a little bit of its kind of, because it's gone through that next level of capitalism. It seems.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be interested because, you know, we will watch it when it's on Disney Plus. I'm curious to see if it's at all sanitized based on the version, the theatrical version, because I have a feeling like it might be, but there's not a whole lot in there. Anyway, I mean, we've gone off the rails on this a little bit, but thank you both. Welcome to the show. This week, we're going to talk about food from a place that no one in America will be able to go to for a very long time because our leadership are idiots. We're going to be talking about European food or continental cuisine. So, I'm going to start with the opening question. And Seth, let's start with you.
Okay.
What's so good about French and Italian cuisine, huh?
We lost you for a sec.
What's so good about French and Italian cuisine?
Well, it's delicious would be my start.
That's a good open.
In the case of French cuisine, they have mastered lovely sauces that go on everything and elevate, you know, a simple piece of meat to something that is a very nice thing to consume. And in the case of the Italians, they've found a lot of ways of using tomatoes that I really approve of.
Yeah,
as an Italian, big fan of tomatoes and their various manipulations.
Indeed.
Great. Courtney, what's so great about French and Italian cuisine, huh?
Well, one, I think the fact that we've taken transcontinental or continental out of how we're describing it is the first step. And actually describing it as their identity. So I think one thing that makes, something that makes French and Italian cuisine so great, and it's really what I think makes every cuisine so great, is there is how it is rooted in that culture's identity. And for Italy, for instance, I think I'll just use the affogato as an example. I think something that Italians do really well is they allow the ingredients to speak for themselves. So simplicity is really what kind of makes Italian cuisine. And so in like the case of an affogato, it's just that you have these two ingredients. You just have espresso and you have vanilla. Ice cream in America, vanilla gelato in Italy. And I think affogato, if my memory serves me, affogato actually translates to drowned. So it's the idea that you're drowning this cold ice cream in this hot espresso. So Italians take
murderous
simple, take really simple ingredients with beautiful textures and elevate them in a way that makes them super delicious. The French, similarly, actually, I think just out of necessity, they take really kind of, I think French cuisine really evolved out of, as most cuisines do, it evolves out of kind of peasant food. And so they took peasant food and added a fuck ton of technique to it. And, you know, sauces were meant to make vegetables and meat that weren't very vibrant during the winter have a lot more flavor. And the French just like to kind of, they are...
When they're not surrendering, they're...
They're
Keep shot, friends. Sorry.
They love to refine things. They love to take things and make them even better. So, they kind of took all of these ideas behind just country cooking and really worked toward refining technique, which I think that is what makes French cuisine so great, is that they refine the technique behind sauces and how to actually make the thing.
When they're not surrendering, they're rendering.
Hey!
Boom! Oh, that was worth every little bit there. That was bold. Yes, sir.
Very good. I mean, that was the wonderful answers. I'm going to give Seth 2 points and Courtney 3 points. And it's time for round one. So, Courtney, you will start round one. Do you have a vague idea about nouvelle cuisine?
Nouvelle just means new. So I have a vague idea that nouvelle cuisine is primarily made of bullshit.
Great.
I think nouvelle cuisine, it takes old techniques and evolves them into what the American palate or what the current palate is today. And sometimes it does it well, and sometimes it forgets it forgets its purpose along the way. So,
yeah, I mean, that's you hit a lot of very valid points. Seth, anything to add about nouvelle cuisine?
So I'm gathering that nouvelle is not just a contraction of Neufchâtel,
the cream cheese,
the weird version of cream cheese.
Yeah, right. What is the difference between those two anyway? I really don't know that I've tasted both, and I can't even pick that out.
Does cream cheese have a third less fat, or does Neufchâtel have a third less fat?
Neufchâtel has a third less fat than regular cream cheese.
That's awfully precise.
And so, and Neufchâtel would be nine houses, nine something. It's not chateau, but it's...
I don't even think it's Neufchâtel, but now that you've said that, that's the only way I can think the word is...
Neufchâtel, right?
Yeah, so neuf is nine in French, so correct. It would be nine something. Nine cows. Neufchâtel, nine cattle.
Nine cattle. Cats. It's like it's chattel. Chattel yeah. is cattle. You yeah. are correct. Chattel.
As in the way that our capitalist overlords deal us as chattel.
and then chattel slavery, and then Black Lives Matter, and now we're relevant. We did it.
Yeah, we did. We won. Okay, great. Everybody gets 100 points and we're done. No, I'm kidding. Okay, Seth, continue on nouvelle cuisine.
I have so much to add about nouvelle cuisine. As Courtney said, it is newer than Adèle cuisine.
Uh-huh.
Sorry, did you say Adèle Dazeem?
Yes. like the brewery?
Well, and this is becoming what you accidentally call Idina Menzel. Mm-hmm. You are saying her name at an award show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you're John Travolta specifically.
If you're specifically John Travolta.
Which all three of us are right now. And I will attest to that. Listener, all three of us are John Travolta right now. We are in a full-on face-off situation.
Indeed. I am in the Saturday Night Fever, John Travolta. You're Grease.
Yeah.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Nate's Pulp Fiction.
What?
We can trade. I'll be Grease. You can be Pulp Fiction.
No.
Okay. Well, hey, nouvelle cuisine is it's an approach to cooking and food presentation in French cuisine, in contrast to cuisine classique. Or haute cuisine. Nouvelle cuisine is characterized by lighter, more delicate dishes. So we're talking about like big plate, tiny little serving, very carefully arranged presentation. And I think, Courtney, you said something to the effect of the bullshit of how it looks.
It's usually very precious is how I understand it to be.
Super precious. And it was popular in the 1960s, specifically a food critic named Henri Gault. Was talking about it, invented the phrase. So yeah, it's just kind of the idea. It's basically what I feel like every sort of joke on a sitcom in the 90s about what a like modern restaurant was or a fancy French restaurant was, oh, well, this is nouvelle cuisine. So, oh, well, I'm paying $20, but I get like a tiny hamburger that's this big because this is an America joke.
One sprig of rosemary, like, across the top of it,
Or like New York, it's you go and you pay $300 and then you leave and you go get a pizza immediately thereafter. That happened a couple times.
I mean, luckily, Famous Ray's is right around the corner.
Usually.
No matter where you are.
No matter where you are, that is probably. Yeah.
Great job. Seth, 1 point. Courtney, 2 points. And we're going into round number two. And Seth, you'll go first. Do you have a vague idea about the Mediterranean diet?
I do have a vague, very vague idea about the Mediterranean diet. We could either take it as like the Mediterranean diet is something that you are sold in books, where you're supposed to eat a lot of olive oil and tomato and fish. Or we could just actually talk about what the diet of people who live around the Mediterranean is, which is very fresh and lovely and delicious. But no, the Mediterranean diet is supposed to make us like, not have so much cardiac disease. We're supposed to live longer because people in Italy don't have so much cardiac disease and they live longer.
And they smoke way more than we do.
They smoke so much more than we do.
Like, they're literally all smoking all the time.
I mean, it's there's something that's not fair about this. And I think actually, I think we're taking the wrong approach, right? We're looking at how they eat. Mm-hmm. And we should be looking at their lives writ large.
How they live.
Yeah.
And so we should all be smoking more and drinking more wine. And that would probably make our hearts beat longer.
We should be doing that with the opportunity to say, hey, it's 3:00. I'm going to leave my office for the next 5 hours and just sit around and talk to people I love.
Yeah. 5 days. Yeah. I mean, the union's got your back, man.
We should all have like a daily mandated nap.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I mean, I would venture that most of our, not most, but a fair amount of our heart disease comes from either the stress drinking that happens after work,
yes,
or the bombardment of coffee that everybody drinks all day long to continue pressing through a work day. I mean, there were times in my life when I was like, coffee at home, coffee at 10 a.m., coffee after lunch, coffee at 3 p.m., and then it was like, oh, wait, why am I like sweaty and agitated all the time? I get it. I get it now.
You know, I have a friend that works in tech, and he was posting the other day how like he spends 75% of his day consuming as many uppers as possible in order to just deal with the day,
yeah,
and then the remaining 25% consuming as many downers as possible to kind of come down from the uppers of the day. So it's
sleep a little bit, wake up, go back. I mean, that's, it's kind of like this episode, we're calling this episode Continental Cuisine, but really this is just capitalist criticism.
Okay, I'm into that. I think that'll even be the episode title.
Yeah.
We got C-squared, Continental Cuisine, capitalist criticism. Just call it C-squared.
All the C's. But it really does illustrate, does it not, the absurdity of what we are expecting. Like, that when we try to make our lives about the thing that we do for a living, mm-hmm, oh, I'm going to be able to wrap this back around. When we try to make our lives about what we do for a living, then our stress levels are ridiculous. We don't have any time to actually just, like, unwind in any meaningful sense. We don't have time to relax and make a goddamn meal or, mm-hmm, or something, as opposed to the Italians, who, granted, are maybe a little bit too on the other direction, but who allow for a lifestyle of, you know, as Eddie Izzard once pointed out very, very beautifully, riding around on scooters going, jaw, which is just a much more, it's like a much healthier approach to being a human being, rather than working 75 hours a week and drowning ourselves in stress. Just ride around on a scooter, go, jaw, drink some wine, smoke a cigarette, make yourself a meal, live life.
Yeah, I would much rather be a person with only a scooter, uh-huh, the ability to buy espresso, cigarettes, and wine, mm-hmm, and feed myself, and have dogs, and my wife, and everything, and a place to live, but none of the other trappings of capitalism that are like, oh, it's so great that you can buy this crap that you don't really like after 15 minutes of owning it. I would take that. I would take an unambitious life. I feel like I've sort of chosen that by proxy in a lot of ways anyway. Like, people I know who are really gung-ho about work, I'm not interested in spending most of my time being devastatedly tired. To what end? To the end that maybe later I'll barely have enough money to skate by when Social Security's gone? I don't know. Anyway.
Let's maybe reframe our idea of ambition. That ambition can include...
Yeah.
You know,
being ambitious enough to want to enjoy the days that you are living now as well as later. And Seth, I want to add that you wrapped it all up very nicely, like a dolma, which is a type of Mediterranean food.
Yes, it is. True. Delicious one.
Courtney, do you have anything to add about the Mediterranean diet?
Yeah. Actually, you know, I think just the very fact that we call something the Mediterranean diet is maybe part of what we're talking. It's part of this bigger conversation.
It's so like wrapped into capitalism because it's something that's packaged and sold to us.
that we as, I mean, I think because we have so little, we, without getting into the broader picture, we tend to like to have a label for something or compartmentalize things in a way that is easily consumable, right? And so whether the Mediterranean diet is something that you're doing because you want to lower your, like, because you want for health purposes or whatever, or whether it's just what we want to call the diet of people who live on the Mediterranean, it's still a pretty, it's a very narrow view of what the Mediterranean diet is, because the Mediterranean diet is, should, I mean, I'm not, this is not a criticism of Seth, but he used Italy as kind of the country that he kept going back to, but Israel would be part of the Mediterranean diet. Lebanon would be part of the Mediterranean diet. Morocco would be part of the Mediterranean diet. So, I mean, the Mediterranean diet really is anywhere on the Mediterranean. It's difficult, I think. And so in order to honor what the Mediterranean diet is, you kind of have to be willing to honor that it is all of these different cultures, that it's based in all of these different cultures. That's very difficult in America, where we don't have the time to think outside of ourselves any longer. So I just find the Mediterranean diet problematic in that way, because I think it narrows, I think just by the very having a label of what it is, it narrows the possibility and the opportunity to truly understand and experience it, which is so many incredibly diverse flavors and preparations, and I mean it's absolutely outstanding,
we should stop calling it the Mediterranean diet, and even though it means exactly the same thing, we should call it the height of the Roman Empire diet.
I mean,
and include like Southern British cuisine, why not?
Really, really amazing. I mean, would it surprise either of you to know that the Mediterranean diet in the context in which I intended it was another thing that was popular in the 1960s? Should not. Because the Mediterranean diet was based on the eating habits of Italy and Greece in the 1960s. It's basically about olive oil, legumes, unrefined cereal, fruit, vegetables, fish, a little bit of dairy, and moderate wine consumption. It was sort of one of those, just like Atkins or any of these other diet fads that are very problematic and destructive and really, to your point, Courtney, I think, manipulate our perspective and our connection to food as well as to other cultures, because we're not actually connecting to anything really, right? We're just saying like, oh, okay, so, I don't want to die because I'm afraid, because America makes me afraid for the most part. So I'm going to buy a book that tells me that what I should do is do this, and I'll do this thing that's actually not really necessarily better than just indulging and not overindulging, but indulging and enjoying. And it's just all part of the formula. So yeah, it's purported to reduce all cause mortality and the risk of chronic diseases. So that's the Mediterranean diet. And yeah, I want to just say thank you, because really wonderfully illuminating conversation. And I completely agree. Like, my wife and I have traveled all over Europe, and we spent time in Provence in France, and Marseille and everything, and Italy, and we haven't been to Greece yet, but hopefully, and I would love to go to North Africa at some point too, when it's safe to do so. Because there is so much, amazing food and culture that happens with the sort of European post-colonialism, where for whatever reason, America sort of decided that like our colonialism wasn't anything that we needed to learn anything from. It was just sort of like, we're going to fuck one way. Whereas it almost seems like Europe kind of decided that they were in a little bit of a relationship in some ways, not everywhere. I mean, there's problems in India, problems with Hong Kong, et cetera, but hopefully we can travel again sometime soon. Seth, I'm going to give you 4 points because I like that you spurred the conversation. And Courtney, I'm going to give you 3 points because you really added a lot of really valuable points. And this takes us into our first game. It's time to play Recast. And so Recast is a game where you have to, I'm going to give you a movie and I need you to just recast the character, the actor in that role. This time it's going to be a little weird. We're going to be recasting the Pixar film Ratatouille, where we have an adorable rat who is a French chef, an aspiring French chef. And so my question and my task posed to you, and Courtney, you can go first, is Remy was a rat, but what other animal should be playing an aspiring French chef? And who should voice that animal?
I would say most animals have better senses of smell than we do as humans, so it would be fun to have to really use an animal. I mean, I think of dogs just because they're the most immediate. We all know dogs have better senses of smell, but that their sense of smell could be what's really highlighted in it.
Okay.
And then sort of on the up opposite side of that, the first animal that came to my brain when you asked that question was a skunk.
Oh,
right? Like Pepe Le Pew.
And maybe it was because of Pepe Le Pew, but also just I thought, these poor skunks, they're just constantly, you know, they're smelly but what if somehow you were able to kind of take that and turn it on its head, that maybe a skunk also loves smells so much that it's not, that they don't just make smells for defense, they also want to like create smells.
A skunk who's really into fragrance, right? Like they're just always working with garlic and ginger and like.
Yes.
Love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just really wants to, yeah. Yeah. Like maybe their sense of smell is like honed in a way that just the rest of the world hadn't quite figured out yet.
Wonderful. What actor would voice your skunk who is aspiring to be a chef?
I don't know why I just thought of Queen Latifah, but
I'm into it. That's great.
She's in this cute. I love her in this movie called The Holiday, where she plays a chef. But Seth.
Yeah, Seth. What do you think? I'll buy it. I like Queen Latifah as a skunk. I think it's an interesting role. So that's great.
Yeah. Yes.
Seth, what do you think?
So I've had a little bit more time to think about my answer, which I feel privileged by, but that doesn't mean that my answer is going to be good. Nevertheless.
Luckily, you're a white male, so you'll probably do well either way. The system works.
Starting with pickups. Sorry, everyone. So what I want to do is take the concept of Ratatouille and kind of reverse it. So instead of a rat, I want it to be an elephant with a tiny person on its head telling it how to cook.
Interesting. An elephant whisperer of sorts.
Indeed. And I think the elephant is probably played by, I mean, you know, in a really demeaning sort of way. I was going to say John Goodman, but...
You know what's funny is John Goodman was the only thing I was thinking of right now too. So, and no fooling at all. Like I genuinely went, yeah, John Goodman can be an elephant. That would be great.
And then I think the person on top of his head that's telling him how to cook is probably Joe Pesci. Because he's a little fella. Mm-hmm. You know?
Okay.
I think that would. I mean, it's no longer a children's movie.
Yeah. Yeah, because Joe Pesci makes that elephant trample some people for real. Like it is curb stomping.
and like his
Coen Brothers style.
His cooking instructions all come in like really long, very adult language oriented rants. Mm-hmm.
The knife skills that he teaches the elephant.
Yeah.
Could be like really.
I mean, does the elephant like, it's doing everything with its trunk, right? I mean, like that's the only way an elephant could cook. One imagines.
I'm loving this idea of an elephant using its trunk to
chop vegetables
to figure things out.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
you know.
I'm into it. I'm into it. Very good.
And it's used to wield a machete.
Like it's.
It's Joe Pesci.
But it's there is something actually kind of nice about the idea of using your nose to cook.
And the machete too is how do you think we got the meat? Yep. You gotta chop somebody. Great job.
Bush meat in Africa, which is just whatever the hell you know they come across, but instead it's the people from the Parisian streets. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's just they just go out they stomp and machete a bunch of people in Parisian streets and cook them into food. There's a little bit of Sweeney Todd happening here.
This is a Blumhouse movie, I think now. Yeah. Not a Pixar movie. Very good. You're both going to get 2 points because you were both absolutely correct. Well done.
Get it.
You correct.
I wrote down 2 answers, one for each of you, and you said exactly what I wrote down, which makes me feel a little concerned at my clairvoyancy. We're going to go into round 3 now, and Seth, we'll start with you. Do you have a vague idea about aquapaza?
Aquapaza is water stopping.
Yeah, it's when you pause water.
Pause water. Mm-hmm. It's a feature, you know, we're getting away from cuisine a little bit here, but it's a feature of the Avatar, The Last Airbender series.
Yeah, okay, that's going to get you a point for bringing up that. Great.
The waterbender pauses. It's when the waterbender stops the water from pouring. That's called aquapaza. But only in the English translation. It's got a longer Japanese name in what I assume is the original language of the show. I don't actually know. Maybe it is originally in English. I have no idea.
One whose relationship with the water is such that they can allow it to proceed or ask it to stop its movement forward and have a conversation, I believe is the original.
There's also elements of the 1990 something film The Abyss happening here.
Yeah, nothing like Ed Harris underwater for conservatively 700 minutes.
Yeah. The water, breathing the water and then interacting with it as a sentient being, which I always, you know, I mean that's a nice thing.
Oh yeah.
Anyway, so that's, I think I have comprehensively and accurately responded to that query.
Very good. Courtney, aquapaza.
So aquapaza is actually a Renaissance term that is pronounced aquapaza. and it's derived from... When wenches used to work the wells to bring water out of the wells, right? And so they were called water wenches. So a water wench, right, would haul the water out of the well. Once the wench had sort of successfully hauled the water out of the well, the other wench, they always work in twos, the other wench would cry, aquapaza! It is a combination of the term huzzah and pizzazz, right? So if the wench really hauled that water out of the well with flair, she got an aquapaza at the end.
That's good. I mean, and well wenches are essential to any small community in history.
Mm-hmm. How we get by without them today is a mystery to me.
What I like is the idea that wench, the thing that you pull cable in on the front of a truck, say, if you're pulling a stump in Texas, is or the same thing. Yeah.
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 It's all the same etymology.
It's actually, I don't know if you know this, but that's where the word wench comes from. Uh-huh. Is because that used to be the job of wenches. Mm-hmm. And then their job was automated away.
Robots.
Invention of bullies.
They're gonna get us all. What I have to say, Courtney, is I really like, and I'm gonna give you an extra point for it actually. So when I was a kid, and this is something that I don't completely remember myself, but it's something that my mother has told me, is that when she would make toast, whenever the toaster would pop, right, I would say toast a pop as a little kid, which just makes me think of Aquapaza.
Aquapaza.
Yeah. Aquapaza. Because I'm rewarding the thing, right? I was rewarding a toaster, but in your telling, we're rewarding an individual water wench for really heaving that water like a champ. So I love that. Yeah, great job. I mean, you're both completely wrong, but Aquapazza is Italian for crazy water, and it's used in Italian cuisine to refer to a recipe of poached white fish that is in an herbed broth, and then, I don't know, like lighter broth, slightly heavier broth, herbs, etc. But it's pretty much just white fish in broth. It kind of looks like ceviche, but it's cooked, right?
Okay. I mean, that's I'm down.
Comparable to cioppino and cacciuccio, which I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. So that's great on my part, but I am Italian in Americanism only. So great job. Seth, 2 points, and Courtney, 3 points. And we're going to zip right on over to round number 4. And Courtney, we're going to start with you.
Okay.
Do you have a vague idea about pot-au-feu?
Ah, yes. Pot-au-feu. It's one of those, one of the many pota of French cooking, in which they just stick a thing in a pot and then call it pot a thing. Feu meaning meaning frogs. So it's a frog in a pot. And they call it feu because when the frog goes in the pot, it's really not a, the poor frog looks like, I mean, it's rather foolish looking.
Very good. Puns are after my own heart, so I will definitely reward that. Seth, pot-au-feu.
Again, you know, I feel like we're deviating from the continental cuisine idea, because it's the ancestor of kung fu in China, but I mean you can understand why they had to revise it a little bit, because the only way you could do pot-au-feu, and where it got its name, it's amazing that in China they were able to anticipate the English language this way. But it was, you had to fight with pots on your head and your feet.
Oh, yeah.
And so there was a lot of clanging and a lot of pot, like when you tried to kick somebody, the key was not to let the pot fly off your foot. Although that could be used as a like surprise tactic, at a distance, if you were able to anticipate the movement of your opponent in that way, that you could just kick the pot at them. But then you were at a disadvantage because you were not allowed to use any appendage that did not have a pot on it. It was a little bit about safety, a little bit about, you know, effectiveness. And that's all I have to say about pot-au-feu.
I think I have a feeling that it might also be a dessert.
What I love about it is that in those pot-au-feu battles, it was really also like you would enter the arena and you would have precisely tuned your pots to the pitch that spoke to you most.
That is correct.
Like, if you came in there and your pots all clanged in you know, that nice solid middle C, and then you just sort of you'd see, right? Because someone would be able to, oh wow, they were able, they're playing with pots that are thin enough and tuned enough that they're like three whole registers above what I'm doing. I don't know if I can fight this bird, because clearly,
I mean, if they were like really high pitched pots, that would be smaller pots, which would indicate smaller feet and smaller head.
But and maybe more speed.
Yeah.
That's the thing you got to worry about.
Happy, you know, like.
Getting in there.
Getting in there.
Getting in there with those tiny penguin feet. Yeah, very good. Again, both wrong, but I love you both so much. So pot au feu is French for pot on the fire, and it's a beef stew. It's one of those sort of commoner French cuisine items. It is, quote, the quintessence of French family cuisine, because you just throw like carrots and vegetables and the little bit of meat you've got in a pot and you cook it, and that's it. That's the whole jam. But that's the sort of thing that, I mean, we don't even really do that here. Like, I guess maybe older generations in America have done more of that. But, I mean, even my grandparents, when they were still around, like, I don't remember them doing, like, just, oh, hey, cool. It's just like a sundry stew. But there's something about it that is really appealing to me. I also have a thing where food in cartoons usually looks really appetizing to me. And is it, yeah. Quick poll. Yeah. Yeah? Seth, what do you think?
Yeah.
Food in cartoons? Yeah, where you're just like, baguettes and cheese and butter always look amazing in cartoons. Where you're like, wow, I can't wait to eat that.
Although,
why can't I have it right now?
You've cited a wonderful example of it not disappointing in reality. Like, yes, yeah. It looks wonderful in the thing, and then you have it, and it is also wonderful.
But that is something in the one thing that I would say is like any type pot au anything is usually just it means it's like a one pot meal. That right. is something that the French do a lot of is the
oh yeah
one pot meal. So that's it's cool to know that that's like kind of the traditional one pot meal. But you hear of a lot of different pot au or pot, you know, which is just.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is like, and I guess the closest proxy is that I have done a lot of crock pot cooking in my life,
yeah.
Especially when I was in college and early out of it, where I was just like, oh, what's the best way for me to get food that's actually good for me? Oh, I can put a whole chicken and a bunch of rice in a crock pot and just go to work and come home. And then you have amazing food for like 3 or 4 days. So great job, Seth. I'm going to give you 3 points because I really loved where you took that. It was an adventure. And Courtney, 2 points. So now it's time for our second game. It's time to play Sip, Bottle, Swill. So this is like Fuck, Marry, Kill, but we're going to do this with wines specifically.
Are you unfamiliar with Fuck, Marry, Kill? Where you're given like 3 names?
Yes.
And then one of like usually celebrities, and you have to pick one that you want to fuck, one that you want to marry.
Oh, God, Mary, as in M-A-R-R-Y.
Right. Not fuck Mary.
Got it.
Yeah, I'm not putting enough breathing space in my line reads, but
fuck,
yeah,
Mary.
So we're going to do sip, which is fucking, bottle, I'm going to order the whole bottle,
okay.
Or swill, it's out of here. And, okay. And Courtney, we'll start with you. So your options for sip, bottle, swill are Malbec, Sangiovese, and Syrah. Which wine will you sip? Which will you order the whole bottle of? And which are you kicking to the curb?
So, Malbec, Sangiovese.
Yes.
Chianti, and what was the third one? Syrah.
Syrah.
Or Shiraz, if you prefer the Australian.
I would sip. Syrah, sip,
bottle,
swill.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm bottle to me means that you are going to drink the whole thing. Is
right.
that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to take it. You're committing to that bottle of that wine.
Got it. I would sip a Syrah, I would bottle a Sangiovese, and I would swill a Malbec.
All right. Very good. Seth, what are you going to do?
I'm just going to stick with that.
No, yeah, you can change it. You want to change it?
I'm thinking maybe I might swill the Syrah and sip the Malbec.
Okay. I mean, I kind of agree with you there. Seth, what do you think?
I'm the same 3 varietals?
Yes. Yeah. Same situation.
Okay. Yeah, let's toss the Syrah to the curb. Don't need it. too full bodied.
Swill is tossing it to the curb?
Yeah, Swill is like, it's out of here.
Okay, no, switch. I'm back to my original answer then. Sorry. I was thinking, like
you're gulping.
Like I'm gulping it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, Swill is in, like, this is Swill. I don't want it. Gross.
I'm
Swill.
Thinking with Malbec is Swill, and I'll sip the Syrah.
All right.
Fascinating. We're okay. Neither of us likes red wine.
I picked all red, so that's good.
I liked it enough to know which ones I would sip.
Right. I mean, same. I've had a lot of red wine in my time. I have enjoyed red wine, but it's like what neither. If we're at the wine store and we're buying wine, it's 99% of the time it's going to be white wine, because we basic like that.
And because white wine actually goes with more things.
White wine does go with more things, and it's just kind of more guaranteed to be it's more of a bottle across the board.
Yeah.
And also, I'm gonna stick with Syrah. Syrah's out. Don't need it. Don't want it. I'm gonna sip the Malbec, and I'm going to have like my person on the left here. You're right. I'm going to the bottle of the Sangiovese. Yes, yeah, let's do that.
All right.
I'm good with Malbec, but I want to sip it. I don't need the whole thing.
You don't need to commit. You're not drinking the whole bottle of that.
Sangiovese, I can that's a nice, it's a lighter red. It's not as much of an affront on, it's not as going to be as heavy on the tannins. I don't know. Here's what happens when I start talking about red wine, is I know words that are associated with talking about red wine, and then I just use them in random order.
In fairness, I did not pronounce Sangiovese correctly in the first time that I said it. So Courtney's clearly got a leg up on everybody here. So yeah, very good. You guys both did excellently. Perfect answers. I have a fondness for Malbecs, I will say, but I like red wine. And if you don't, that's cool. 2 points each. Well done on Sip Bottle Swill. And now, from the makers of Pomme ou Pomme de Terre, it's right. La Chose Française Arbitraire. That's the arbitrary French thing. And the only thing that's French about it is the name. So, Seth.
Yep.
What is your favorite European dish? And I want you to describe it in delectable detail.
It's a whole fucking continent, man. How am I going to narrow it down? How, my favorite European dish?
I'm just asking you to pick one. It doesn't even have to be your favorite, but something in your top 10.
Okay. How I am going to interpret this question is... my favorite memory of eating a dish in Europe.
All right, I like it.
That I'm narrowing it. I'm narrowing down the experience. This because if I'm trying to even a top 10, Courtney's abandoning me while I ramble incoherently.
I like your idea. I like what this is going to be, which is you're going to give us some insight into your actual life.
My real life I've lived. So, and this allows me also to tell a story. So many years ago, and by that I mean 17 years ago.
Whoa.
When
you
I
were
was
nine?
When I was a fledgling adult, I traveled with my father to the country of Greece, which was lovely. I mean, it's lovely. It's a beautiful country. I strongly recommend anyone go visit the country of Greece, though not as we did in the month of July, because it's hot. It's so hot. It was 120 degrees when we got there.
I would assume it's both hot and terribly humid at that period, at that particular time.
First we were on an island, on the island of Rhodes, which was not so humid. And actually, most of the country's not too bad in that respect, but it is, it's so hot.
Did you meet any Rhodes scholars while you were on the island of Rhodes?
Hey-o.
I mean, that's what it's named for, right?
It's the same guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Much like I believe Rhode Island, and also the erstwhile country of Rhodesia, which no longer bears that name because they got over the idea of colonialism. They decided they didn't want to be named for a white guy anymore because they're in fucking Africa.
Yeah, yeah. They were like, hey, we're not an undiscovered continent, so thanks. Yeah. Bye, bitch.
We have our own rich lives here already. So, yeah. Anyway, so my favorite meal that we had there was my favorite because of the simplicity of the experience and the deliciousness of the food. The whole of Greece has delicious food. Like, you just, there is nowhere that you go there, nicely run, where the food is shitty. Everything is lovely, everything is prepared well, all the meats are, like, delectable, and everything is spiced fabulously, and so on, because they are a people who value nice, good food.
Mm-hmm.
But my favorite experience, we were driving, I think we were somewhere in the Peloponnese, and we needed some lunch, as you do from time to time. And so we stopped in this little tiny town. Nobody there. There were two restaurants, one on either side of the road. And we stopped at the one on the side of the road on which we were driving, because that was practical, and sat down. We were the only people in the restaurant. There was no menu. The guy just came up to our table and it said, seeing that we were not a Greek, and correctly assuming that we spoke English, said, lamb or chicken. Those were our options.
Great. I mean, I hope you chose lamb.
We did.
Good. Yeah. Because that's what you should do in that situation.
I mean, I'm sure the chicken would also have been delicious, but the lamb was amazing.
Yeah.
And what was extraordinary about sitting there at this place was you could hear the chickens and the lambs in the back making their chicken and lamb noises.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of like, it was this very extraordinary relationship. And I think this is something that I really value when I eat, is this extraordinary relationship with where the food came from, because we were sitting on the front porch of the restaurant, and behind the restaurant is where the brothers and sisters of the lamb that we were eating continued to reside until it was their turn to meet their fate. Which, I mean, you know, like, there's a morbid aspect to it, I think, for a lot of people when they, but that's just confronting the reality of the thing that you're doing, which is eating an animal.
Yeah.
At one point, it was alive, and it was a little cute lamb, and it was walking around doing the things and being a lamb. And then later it was killed and it was put on your plate. And also, in addition to all of the relational aspects to it and the kind of like nice thing about stopping at a restaurant on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere in Greece, it was fucking delicious. The meat was so extraordinarily tender. It was well spiced. It came with, you know, like a little bit of veg, a little bit, you know, like a little salad, a little, you know, a little bit of bread and all these things that are just kind of like the things that you need to round out a good meal. But the center, of course, was the meat. And everything was just perfectly, like, it was perfectly prepared, perfectly balanced, and it was a sincere joy to consume every part of that brother or sister of the critters who were in the back. That's
very
my
good. Story. Yeah, you know, I will add one of the. So my father and I have gone fishing constantly throughout my life, and a lot of the end of every fishing trip is the sort of taking a moment to thank the fish for being like, hey, you know, we caught you, we're gonna eat you, sorry.
Yeah.
and that was part of the ceremony of going through the whole process of killing and gutting and everything else, right? Like, and I think that's really important. You hit on something very valid, which is we have to feel connected to food in some way, where it's even just basic gratitude to say, like, okay, cool. You weren't really, you know, you weren't going to invent a rocket ship. You're not going to be Elon Musk, Mr. Sheep, but you sure had a good life, and we appreciate you for what you've given.
And if they were going to be Elon Musk, we should definitely eat them.
Yeah. I mean, we should probably just eat Elon Musk, I think is the obvious answer. Get that PayPal money.
Elon. We got an elephant with a machete. We're on our way.
Man, if Hannibal was confronting elephants with machete in the Alps, too. Think about that.
I was going to make a Carthage reference earlier when I was doing the Mediterranean diet and the height of the Roman Empire and all those things, because Carthage was in northern Africa and blah, 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 blah. So, yes, this is all tying together very nicely. Anyway, carry on.
Hannibal also.
Hannibal did like Sangiovese, as is well known.
With some fava beans and some liver.
Mediterranean.
Indeed. And Elon Musk's fucking liver.
Yeah. Or Ray Liotta's brain, either way. Courtney, so go ahead and what is your favorite European dish? However, I mean, if you want to go Seth's route, which is this was a specific dish that I ate that was delicious, great. If you have one in mind, awesome. If you just want to talk about European food, phenomenal. Hit us with it.
Well, when you asked that question, the first thing that came to mind was, for me, was whole fish, mm-hmm. which I think actually connects to a lot of what we've just said, obviously. But when I've never been to Greece, but I lived, I think, in a neighborhood that was about as close to Greece as you're going to get in America, called Astoria, in Queens, where they have, they have the highest population of Greeks in Astoria outside of Athens. At least that was one statistic that used to be there. They also have a really high population of, Mediterraneans in general, North Africans being one of them. And I used to go to, a friend of mine named Ali owned a restaurant that was about the size of like my entire little hobbit kitchen here. Kind of in similar form as what Seth was talking about. You walked in and you would just, there are three tables and he was your host, your server, and your chef. Yeah. And so he would come and ask you, tell you what he had that day. And then he would go and make it for you. And if you brought him a bottle of wine, he was even happier about it. And he'd like drink the wine and talk to you while you were eating.
I love that stuff. Honestly, I gotta say, I mean, and this is, again, hey, look, we've been talking about capitalism earlier, but this is the problem with capitalism is that like everybody's paid not to care instead of being compensated to care or being compensated to be involved. Cause I think that's the best part of any sort of food experience, especially is going into places and like, hey guys, I've got a really great thing for you today. I have two options. You get to pick between the two things, but I'm very excited about them. Instead of like, well, we have 72 menu items and we don't care about any of them.
Which I think is what my problem with the idea of transcontinental cuisine is that it's non-committal and it feeds into kind of the American idea that we should always have a choice.
Right.
And that we always should have as many choices as we want. And I think actually like we've really, because of that notion that's perpetuated, because of the have it your way kind of notion that's perpetuated, mm-hmm. We're really disallowing an opportunity for experience that is there when choice is sort of removed, when you allow someone else to be making, to kind of curate the choice for you. And I think that that's, when I think about that phrase transcontinental cuisine, just breaking it down across continent cuisine, like cuisine, if I had to come up with a definition for it, and this is not fact, but if I had to come up with a definition for it, I would say that cuisine is when technique meets necessity.
Interesting.
So
I like that a lot.
If you think, cuisine is always rooted in necessity. Like this was what could be grown in that area geographically. This was what people could afford. This was what was available when it was available. You know, we don't get tomatoes in January, right? So cuisine is kind of the evolution of that necessity, with technique. And so I think when we remove that necessity and make it about all of the different possible choices that we could have, you know, going into like an, I mean, no one would say that Applebee's is cuisine, but I'm saying like what they're trying to do.
I hope not.
You go into an Applebee's.
I don't know. There are a lot of people in the state of Nebraska. So yeah, sorry. Nebraska.
But even now, like even in sort of these higher end restaurants, there is sort of propensity of chefs and owners, or I've experienced this in restaurants that I've worked in, where there's a little bit of a fear to really commit to an identity.
Right. Sure.
Because that removes the choice from the consumer. But at the same time, then it removes to me part of what makes it cuisine. So I think all I would say about my favorite meal is that I love when the choice is removed, because that, or when a certain amount of the choice is removed for me, because then it becomes about the experience. I get to sit back and have the experience. And then just technically, I love whole fish because when it's grilled or seared, however it's made, and you get this beautiful crispy skin that texturally is fantastic, and they always sear that moisture right into the meat of the fish, so you get that, that's beautiful. And then you see the head and the tail, you see the full thing. If you're not going to eat a whole, I mean, you might eat a whole pig in a luau, but like there's rarely the opportunity, right, where you are seeing the whole animal in front of you, and you, or the whole thing in front of you that you get to eat. And I also, the other thing I like about it, and I specifically like about a lot of Mediterranean cuisine, is that it encourages you to eat with your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So a mezze plate and even a whole fish, it encourages you not to be too precious about the way you are actually eating the food. It's just getting in there and getting that perfect bite in your mouth. Mm. And that encouragement of eating with your hands then encourages community, right? Because you are all in there eating this thing together with each, everyone's just dipping and grabbing and making their own perfect bites. And it's kind of around this, it's not a solo experience where you're sitting with just a knife, right?
It's everything we can't be doing right now because there's a goddamn
pandemic. maybe that's actually why I'm thinking about it as my favorite thing, is because part of it is exactly what I wish we could do.
Yeah. And I don't blame you at all, because you're right. I mean, the one that food should be this thing that's sort of, one, we should be understanding and reverent of what we're eating, right? Like when we were the French Riviera, every single time I got a fish dish, you got the whole fish. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't bother me at all. Like I get why it would bother someone to be like, oh, it's looking at you. But
it has,
you
know, eyes.
But the thing is it would have looked at you before. Like, you're basically like, if you just want to go to styrofoam and saran wrap and say like, well, this thing wouldn't have looked at me. No, it would have looked at you. And most of them probably would have been your friend. Like a cow would have been like, hey, I love you a lot. I don't have a lot of aspirations, but I would like to hang out because I'm a charming dullard. And that's what cows are, and that's okay if we accept what it is. But to your point about choice especially, which I think is so, so important, is the idea that like we really fixate on choice in this country in a way that does not make any sense. Like we fixate on choice as basically like we have so embraced choice as a concept that what we're most interested in is the idea that we can have either nothing or something as a choice, which is terrifying, because we should be in a position where we're like, no, we should at most have a baseline followed by, we can have these different options. They're all fairly similar, but it's been so manipulated. I mean, I think you did a wonderful job.
Privilege that it has lost, that we've lost our understanding of what certain choices, where certain choices are a right, I suppose, and where certain choices are a privilege. But
like the fucking mask thing, like,
you know, certain choices should just be, I don't know, it's hard. We are so fixated on choice, and I think it's maybe grounded in something that makes sense, that choice should be a right and not a privilege. I think it's it's gotten to such a point of self-entitlement that we no longer recognize we're no longer honoring where it comes from, I guess, in a certain way.
I think my perfect restaurant would be one where I can go, you know, and I know it's going to be like $15 or $20 or whatever, maybe even $25 or $30. Like if I don't know. But there is no menu. I sit down and I get what I get. And I know it's going to be great because I know the chef and I know the chef gives a shit about what they're doing and all of these things. But I have absolutely no autonomy as the person who's being fed there as to what I'm going to eat. I just, like, it's going and enjoying the experience of being fed this thing that somebody else has created, regardless of what, you know, like, I don't care what it is. I just want to know.
Your choice in that scenario is you chose to go to that restaurant, which is a choice in itself, right?
Exactly.
And I think that's interesting. Because we talk about like, well, yeah, obviously, women should have control over their own bodies, which has been labeled as choice in our society. And it's problematic to label it that way because it's really not about that. It's about, am I a person or not? But it's also like choice around the way that healthcare is packaged in this country, where it's like, hey, you should have your choice of doctor. And it's like, well, you should, but you should also just be happy that everybody can go to a doctor. Like choosing like, oh, well, I like this guy because his eyebrows are this way. Like, fuck that. That's, some choices are stupid. That's all I'm saying.
And as one final thought on the matter, the choices, like our conception of freedom, right, is like the freedom to choose things.
Yeah.
Which is a shitty conception of freedom because what it is not taking into account is the freedom that is allowed for through security, right? Like if I have healthcare, if I know that I can go to a doctor and be taken care of, then that allows a freedom to be in the world in a way that, you know, is not overly, like I don't have to constantly think about not getting sick or not getting injured or something along those lines, because if I do, I'm taken care of, right?
Yeah.
So I have a freedom. And there's freedom in like a financial security that if I don't have to worry about, you know, like how I'm going to pay the rent, then I have a freedom over what I'm doing for a career or for an occupation or whatever. So, you know, it's like freedom to choose what fast food I want is kind of, I don't care about that. Like that's dumb choice.
Yeah.
Express who I am as a human being in the world is much more interesting. Like freedom to self-actualize as a human is way more important. And that can only be provided, you know, like you can only get there through providing, you know, like is kind of the way you were talking, a baseline of security, of stability, of all of these things,
right,
so that you can discover and express.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, that can be kind of boiled down into the restaurant idea. Like I don't need to choose what I'm eating at the restaurant because I have the stability and security to know that I am going to a place where I'm going to be fed and fed well, and I'm going to be happy and I'm going to be with people I love.
Yeah.
And that to me is far more important than whether I, you know, like, do I want the fucking cheese on this salad or not? And what's the salad doing coming with cheese anyway?
But I also, I mean, I also, I, you know, I think that food has become so twisted, and particularly the way we view food in a commercial sense in America has become so twisted, because really being able to go to the kind of restaurant where you don't have a choice in that way is almost a sign of privilege.
Sure.
Whereas our current market, whereas the restaurants in which whereas the restaurants or the food purveying establishments where there are a vast number of choices tend to be marketed in such a way or are geared towards such a way a certain economic group of people where the food is cheap, there's not a lot of care that's put into it, and it's mass-produced, so they're able to create meet their, you know, their margins. And so in a way, it's like we're sort of ruining food for an entire economic
group of people
who don't have as many choices in their lives as the as some folks in higher economic brackets, and so we're giving them these it's like it's almost feels like a consolation prize. It almost feels like this big kind of scam to me that we allow so many choices at a place like Denny's or Applebee's or whatever, have it your way is what Burger King, right? Like,
yeah.
We have so many choices. We're sort of giving the facade that you have a choice, that you have so many choices. You have the power here. When in reality, that no, you are not, you know, the places where you have that many choices are representing the complete lack of power that people in certain economic positions in our country have, which is access to well-prepared, nutritionally sound food that is not prohibitively expensive. That is not something that we have in this country that is a choice that is that available for an enormous percentage of people. So, you know, I get frustrated because we can't really damn the app. We can't really damn the McDonald's or the places that have all these choices. We have to damn the system behind them that has created this enormous disparity in where we're able to have access to food and what we want to as and how we as Americans value with our dollar bill and value with what we actually think is valuable regarding food.
Once again, fuck capitalism.
It is crazy that to a great extent, the food that is available to people inexpensively is less quality than the idea of a prison bread and water diet. Like if you were just provided with legit bread and water, you would almost be better fed. I mean, the idea that you would just get like, okay, well, here's half of a baguette, a tiny block of cheese, and a cup of water. You are better off than being a person who is like, oh, I live in a food desert. My option is to go to 7-Eleven and buy whatever, you know, neon flame Doritos are available and then die. So yeah, great job, guys, on La Chose Francaise Arbitraire. That was a long one, but I'm happy we did it. Seth, 4 points. Courtney, 6 points. And it's time for the final topic. So Courtney, we'll start with you on the final topic. Do you have a vague idea about service à la Russe?
Service à la Russe?
Oui, oui.
I believe that is Russian-style service.
That is correct, yeah.
Which, you know, I guess this isn't correct, so I'm just going to go, but I'll go with it. I remember when I first, in my first rest, the days when I first started working in the hospitality industry, I did a lot of catering. And in New York, you would learn how to it was a certain style of service that you would learn. Yeah. I believe if it's service à la Russe, everyone, first, you start by serving the vodka on your left. You serve to the serve the vodka to the left, and then you clear the caviar potatoes on from the right. That's the service, and then everything ends. All of those services end with a samovar tea service, in which you steep very strong tea in a samovar and drink it while reading a Chekhov play.
Very good. And the play was presented early in the meal, so you knew it was going to come back later.
Yes.
Seth, service à la Russe.
Well, the first thing that you have to understand is that it's gone through several iterations. So for a long time, service à la Russe referred to, you know, like you'd go to the restaurant and you could, you know, like you could get some food, but you really, you had to work for it.
Mm-hmm.
And your server wasn't so much a server in the sense that they were serving you. The server was actually somebody who told you constantly what you were eating, and it was never good.
Mm-hmm.
But what was great was the regular customers, you know, of restaurants that provided service in this way. Regular customers were like, no, 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 we are not going to allow for this anymore. They did just murder the servers.
Like, okay, yeah, great.
But you know, it was fine. Because then they had this really wonderful idea of it being, you know, like a real people's-oriented dining experience. And you know, like they had a plan to, over the next 5 years, develop it into something that worked for everyone who wanted to eat there. You could go, you could eat, you know, and it was provided in, you know, yeah, it was like limited, but then the person who was leading this conceptualization had a stroke, which was unfortunate, and and the guy who took over was highly problematic, and he decided that actually, you know, like the everyone sitting at the bar could no longer have potatoes, which was the only thing that was available to eat at the bar, which was unfortunate, and so half the people at the bar died.
They just had bowls of potatoes on the counter. The way that we might have bar nuts. You just grab just one. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's earthy.
Yeah. I mean, it's Russian style, so you just kind of, you like in true Russian, in the true Russian way, you just deal with it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And anyway.
Or you like talk about it a lot.
Right.
You eat it and then you like get into the minuscule,
right?
It's the
little details about every aspect,
mm-hmm,
of the flavor and the texture and the memories that you have, mm-hmm, all of the memories that you have that are associated. Mm-hmm. See, we're mixing political history, mm-hmm, and literary style. Enjoy. Anyway, so the point being that it went on like that for a long time, and then finally people got really sick of how it was actually playing out, but it wasn't really the people who were sick of it, it was more like the people who were in charge of how things were being, and they decided they wanted to get rich, and so they made it a very for-profit like restaurant venture, and ended up, you know, like then the people had to work very hard for food that they didn't have any choice in consuming. And then the servers were once again not servers so much as they were masters who just told people what they were going to eat. And anyway, it came full circle back to how they started, except now we were in a contemporary capitalist system instead of a feudalist system under the Tsar. We had Putin. So that is a political history of Russia told through the analogy of a restaurant.
Very good. Yeah, so service à la Russe is service in the Russian style. It basically is about courses in service. So you get each course individually, you eat it, it's cleared, you eat the next one, it's cleared, etc., etc. It is contrasted to service à la Française, which is the, we're just going to kind of family style it. Everything's out on the table, you guys just dig in. So yeah, it's just sort of a formality thing, but very good. I mean, you both really delved into wonderful, wonderful worlds with this. So Seth, I'm going to give you 4 points because you really went deep on it, and Courtney 2 points. And guys, I have sad news, which is that the game is over and one of you has won, which means one of you has lost. And I know that we're not in great times for losing, because nobody wants to lose right now. Everybody just, we would like to just all kind of hang, right? But one of you is one of you is a loser tonight, and
one of you is a loser.
I hope.
and Courtney, yeah, you have won with 25 points.
Yay!
Congratulations.
Aku Bazaar!
Aku Bazaar! Seth, you got second place with 24 points. It was very, very close.
Woo!
This was a good one. You guys definitely know your way around continental cuisine, as well as just the nuances of the destructive nature of capitalism and how to enjoy eating food. This was really, really amazing. Thank you guys so much for the time to do this.
Thank you for facilitating it, Nate.
Yeah. So
what a great idea.
So Courtney, do you have anything that you would like to plug? Is there anything you want people to do, to pay attention to know about? Let them know.
What? Plug?
Well, usually, historically, this is the time at which we would say.
Yeah, you'd say, like, hey, I got a show going on, et cetera.
But, I mean, living in this COVID world, I mean, interpret it as you will, I guess.
Yeah. I'm working on something right now, but I'm working on something. An interactive live cooking show for kids, actually.
Ooh, cool.
That is, rather than it being about tuning in and watching Miss Courtney make a recipe, it is kind of a little bit more in the realm of this game, where it's lesson plan. I mean, it's teacher based. It's lesson plan based. So that we have something that we're exploring that day, whether it's learning a mother sauce, and then having a conversation around how food connects us to culture.
Okay.
So I would plug that more because my best friend Carmen, who's from Mexico, is going to be kind of my sidekick with it. But I really want it to be something where it's a community driven thing. Mm-hmm. So if there's anyone that would be interested in being a guest or has a recipe that's really special to them and based in, you know, really special to them and their family or their culture in some way, I'm looking for any kind of minds and contributions in that regard.
Great.
So, if you have kids that want to learn how to cook,
How could such people contact you to participate?
Well, you could reach out through my email, which is really, really long. And then someday soon we'll have a website that's on its way up. So I'm kind of plugging this before it's ready to be plugged.
Hey, that's fine. I love good ideas that aren't ready yet. That's what life is about, right?
You can give them my email.
You can reach out to ascertaining, that's ascertaining @gmail.com. Okay. And that is an email address that will reach Courtney Esser.
It will reach me.
The ascertaining Courtney Esser. Great. Very good. Seth, anything you'd like to plug?
So the first time I did this podcast, I remember I had so many things to plug. I started plugging things, and then you got up and, like, went to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Came back, and I was still plugging because it was a long list. And now, because of the state of the world that we live in, I have no things that I am working on directly. However, I would like to plug the idea of standing up for our brothers and sisters in the world and fighting against injustices against all people, whether you know them personally or not, because we live in a time of collective responsibility and we need to be able to adhere to that. And so I plug collective responsibility for the future and well-being of humankind.
Goddamn right. Well done. Thank you guys again. listeners, thank you for listening to the show. If you like this program, please subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow us on social media. You can look us up. It's A Vague Idea. There's not another A Vague Idea podcast, so I trust you to use your fingers and the enter key. Otherwise, I will say, let's go ahead and plug Black Lives Matter. We will plug charities for Native American populations who are specifically being just decimated by COVID. And we will talk, let's bail funds too. And really just anything, like give to whatever you care about right now, because this is the time. We have the opportunity to do amazing things right now while many of us are semi-employed or slightly differently employed, where we can call our state reps, our senators, our whoever's, and complain. We've got the moment, so we should seize it.
Punch a Nazi.
Yeah,
it's not a Nazi. Wash your hands immediately afterward, but, you know, find a Nazi, punch him in the face, kick him in the nut.
If you can rig up some sort of system where you punch and it immediately squirts a sort of hand sanitizer on you so you can punch again, get at it.
Or if you rig a, like, Inspector Gadget, you know, scenario where there's a big punching fist that comes out of your arm.
That's a way to do it.
And I mean, maybe the theme of this has been about food. There's a really food and capitalism. There's a great charity called No Kid Hungry, which I'm connecting this little teaching thing with, that it provides, particularly right now, a lot of kids depend on their meals from school. And so when we, because school hasn't been available to kids, it's become even more of an issue. And we have a lot of teachers going out of their way to make sure that those kids are getting the meals that they would be normally depending on, although school's now out, but I'm sure it will be a problem again in September when school's back in. But
oh yeah,
Hungry provides some really great resources to families that don't have as much access to food.
Yeah, that's
one that's very near and dear.
Hugely important. Very good plug. So thank you guys again for being on the show. Congratulations, Courtney, on your win. That is this episode of Vague Idea. We've all had a vague idea about continental cuisine, and that's a good thing because the devil is in the details. Bye-bye!
What is that a creature behind you?
Yeah, what is behind you?
It's Rocket. Rocket.
All I saw were the ears, and I thought it was a rabbit.
A Vague Idea is written and produced by me, Nate Regolia, with Shannon Page, and sometimes John Perros. Information about topics often come from Wikipedia, so hey, why not donate a bit to that? Sound effects are Creative Commons public domain. If you like this podcast, tell a few people, and subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen. And if you happen to like reading science fiction, check out the small press I started with my friend Sean Grokowski. You can find Spaceboy books at readspaceboy.com.